Reel 17.
As I was packing, getting ready for Bing Crosby, I noticed my crew weren't. They're just hanging around smoking their gauloises, as always. And it seemed that the French embassy had decided to stay. The French reckoned that they would be safe because, you know, their colonial history. The Americans and the Brits would not be. So Lucien and Jacques said they would stay. They said the war is not over yet. You know, the story is not over. They're not finished. They'd also noticed that another old buddy of ours, Neil Davis, who at the time was working for AP, I think, or NBC, AP then, I think, a cameraman, one of the bravest men I've ever known. He was staying, so Jacques said, you know, he had to stay too. And I said, you know what that means? If you stay, I've got to stay. And I'd been there, you know, 4 months, and I was ready for out. But again, along comes ITN's gentleman, Sandy, who speaks fluent French, and said, look, it's only fair. I speak French. You've been here longer. First in, first out, you go. So he stayed. So that was grand. We thought we would have we'd wait. Just skipping a bit. The previous night, we which we knew would be our last night in Saigon, Sandy had brought with him a bottle of Chateau Lafite, which he'd paid some enormous sum of money for in Bangkok. And he said he was going to open it on our last night. Which, of course, we never did. So I said to Sam, well, you know, open up the bottle, you know, because we won't have a chance otherwise. Let's drink now. Oh, no, man, he said, it's cost me a fortune off, man. You know, it's got to breathe. Oh, rubbish, he said, Sam, rubbish, let's have it. And even the French crew said, forget that breathing, Sandy, you know, let's open it up. And this, oh, no, said Sandy, oh, you know, can't do that, old man, decent bottle of wine. He said, I tell you what, I'll take it across to Romancho's, and who's ever left behind can open it up, and I'll tell the proprietor to let it breathe. So that's what happened. Of course, I learned many months later, after they got out, that they'd all gone round that night of liberation, found the bottle of Lafitte on the table, toasted and spat it out. It was vinegar. It turned into vinegar. This dear old Sandy. Anyway, Sandy stayed behind. We waited for Bing Crosby and White Christmas. Everyone tuned to the radio. Never happened. Suddenly coaches turned up, driven by Americans who had never driven in Saigon in their lives before, had no idea where to go. We all clambered aboard, camera crews leaving their cameras behind. It was total pandemonium. They took us to the docks. That wasn't the place to be. People clinging to us. There was the most horrific incident. We were in these American Army coaches that had open windows, but they had a mesh at the windows to stop grenades being thrown in, which is what used to happen. And as we were leaving the docks, some woman grabbed hold of the wire mesh with her fingers and clung to the side of the bus. And she had two little children in her arms. She kept saying, take them, please take them, please take them. Of course, we couldn't even if we'd wanted to. And eventually she dropped the children and we ran over them. We went under the rear wheels. So eventually we get to the American Embassy. And almost impossible to describe the scene there, because by that time you could hear the tanks crossing Newport Bridge. You could hear the sound of rifle fire, machine gun fire. They were literally only a few miles away. And total pandemonium. People looting, soldiers stripping off their uniforms, people trying to climb into the American embassy, Marines shooting at people who tried it. It was a state of war within a war. People had been told that only those with who'd worked for the Americans or who had a special permission from the Americans could leave. Now, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people surrounding the embassy. We had to fight our way through to get to the wall. I wrote in my commentary later, we fought and clawed our way through women and children to get to the wall. And we did fight and we did claw. And I ended my commentary by saying, we were not proud of what we did that day. But we did get to the wall. And again, astonishing, I think it's a special tribute to the kind of people that ITN once employed. Having recorded the last battle of Vietnam exclusively, my cameraman Peter Wilkinson was the only man to film the melee, the what was going on. And we would not have left that embassy, we would not have got out of Vietnam had it not been for one Marine who was on top hauling over people, just pulling them up, you know, white people, European people. All the others got a kick in the face. And he hauled us up over the wall. And Peter filmed me and the sound recorder Hugh Thompson being hauled up over the wall. And there, on the other side of the wall, inside the compound, embassy compound, were all the people waiting to be airlifted off. And suddenly the huge helicopters came in. He called them the Jolly Green Giants. Sami, they were airlifted out of Phnom Penh. And people were in a queue, Vietnamese, Europeans alike, headed into these helicopters. Of course, what we didn't know was what was going on inside the embassy. They were burning everything they could. There's always a custom that you don't burn the stars and stripes, you know, you kind of carry it with you, and all the portraits of presidents past, you know, hang up in American embassies, ought to be carefully wrapped up and taken up. But of course, in the final moments, they were just trampled on and smashed to pieces. And it was our turn to leave. They beckoned us to the helicopter. We ran. Then we were told to go back. And as we went back, we were told to come again. I think in a matter of seconds, we kind of ran in a circle. But we boarded the helicopter and we were away. And as we lifted off, astonishing thing, the American embassy staff had shredded all their secret documents. They just piled them into bins. But as we lifted off, the updraft of the helicopter lifted all the shredded paper out of the bins. It looked as if it was snowing. I remember saying it was like a ticker tape, New York ticker tape welcome rather than the Saigon goodbye. But looking back now, I remember being Crosby White Christmas. It really was a kind of white Christmas. It was snowing as we left Saigon. And as we lifted out over the river, out towards the South China Sea, where the aircraft carriers were waiting to receive us, we passed over Newport Bridge, the scene of my last battle. It was on fire. And you may remember me telling you, it was shaped in an arc, this great span across the river. And there was this kind of quarter circle of fire. What the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese had done apparently was pour petrol on the tarmac and set fire to it to stop the tanks coming across. So there was this arc of fire. Again, it was like a movie. And that was our last. That was our last sight of Vietnam. Then we landed on the aircraft carrier. I think it was at the Hancock. I think we should have landed in the. Was it the Okinawa? It was the Okinawa, I think. And then we were transferred to the Coral Sea. But as we landed, you know, we expected to be greeted by the Americans with open arms and a great deal of hospitality. But as we landed, we were herded to the side of the ship and we were told to stand against the rail and drop our trousers. which took some believing, as you can imagine, having been through. I mean, I haven't described entirely what happened that day. It's impossible to recall it all in detail, and so much of it now sounds like make-believe, but it was perhaps one of the most horrendous days of my life. So to be told by a huge black staff sergeant to drop one's trousers and bend over was, to say the least, something of a disappointment. And then he put a condom on his middle finger, which must have been the size of a frankfurter, and stuffed it up my bottom and did it each in turn. And when we asked him why, as politely as we could, he said he was looking for drugs. And I said, you really don't expect to find drugs up my bottom, do you? He said, you guys will stuff it anywhere. And my son recorder's Hugh, who has a rather camp sense of humour, said, oh, that was nice, can I go around again? And when he came to me, he said, well, you've got a tight ass. And I said, my friend, if you'd been through what I've been through today, you'd have a tight ass as well. And so ended my war in Indochina.
To Cambodia at all?
Well, I seldom went to Vietnam without going to Cambodia, because it was so close. It was a half an hour's flying time from Saigon, or if you had a death wish, it was a half a day's drive. I first went there in 1970. It was I think it was March 1970, certainly 1970, and it was the coup, the CIA coup. You know, the Americans were beginning to dabble again, and they decided that Prince Sihanouk, Norodom Sihanouk, who was a very unpredictable, precocious young man, could not be trusted to play the American line in keeping the communists out. You may remember I told you how the Ho Chi Minh Trail went all the way down the kind of, well, not the, I suppose you could call it the spine. It wasn't the center of Vietnam. It was the western side of Vietnam along the Laotian and Cambodian border. That was the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which the Americans and the South Vietnamese had to destroy, because it was bringing the thousands of men and supplies down from the north for the fight in the south. Now, once that Ho Chi Minh Trail went into Cambodia, as it had to do, the Americans decided they had to get involved in Cambodia too. They had to stop that trail. Now, Sihanouk was playing a very funny game, the prince. He was playing a little game with China, as well as a little game with the Vietnamese, and a little game with the Russians. He thought he would cover all his corners. Americans wouldn't put up with this. They wanted somebody who was obviously on their side and was determined to do their bidding. And the man they chose was a funny old colonel called Lon Nol, who became a general. And he was a total American sycophant. Now, that obviously heralded a war. If the North Vietnamese wanted to get their supplies through, they had to fight the Cambodians. Now, this was a perfect opportunity for the virtually unknown communists that were in Cambodia to suddenly emerge. Up until then, they were virtually unknown. I mean, nobody had ever heard of the Khmer Rouge, the Red Khmers, the communist Khmers. But as soon as the North Vietnamese needed somebody to help them fight Lon Nol and his little army and the CIA, they started to supply the Khmer Rouge with the aid of the Chinese too. I mean, as you know, the Chinese were at that time very active mischief makers in that area. So all of a sudden there was a resurgence, because I said we'd hardly ever heard of them, but the emergence of the communist Cambodians, the Khmer Rouge. And I remember vividly I suppose you could call it the beginning of the Cambodian War. a little troop. It was like Fred Kahno's army. It was a rag bag army of young kids, mostly innocent people who had never been to war before. You have to remember that Cambodia was a war-free country. It had hardly ever been to war. It was a small country. It wasn't strategically important anywhere. It had somehow escaped the ravages of Vietnam and all the things that went on around it. Very beautiful country, staggeringly beautiful country, and very innocent people. I mean, I don't care if I sound patronizing or not, but the fact is that when you first went to Canberra, you were struck by the kind of naivety, innocence of people. Even politicians seemed to be living in another planet. They were so kind of stress-free. And all of a sudden they were being plunged into war. Now, because they had never been to war before, they having had no experience of fighting, they assumed that their little collection of... I mean, it's impossible to describe that day because it was a circus. They had a couple of old French armoured cars that could barely... I mean, I remember that they had to push start one of the armoured cars to get it going. They had guns that the French had left behind in the 30s and the 40s, which again probably had never ever been oiled or fired, and guys carrying an assortment of rifles, including, I remember clearly, some of the old Brown Besses, you know, that were used by the British in the turn of the 19th century. I mean, it was a real shambles. And at the front of it all, and imagine it was wonderful television pictures. And at the front of it all was a young kid, he couldn't be more than, I don't know, 10, 12 years old, very proud, very erect, marching at the front of this so-called armoured column, with carrying the Khmer flag, the Cambodian flag. It was a red flag with the, if I remember rightly, picture of Angkor Wat, you know, the temples of Angkor Wat, which are the most, you know, the sacred shrines in Angkor Wat, one of the great marvels of Cambodia. This golden symbol on this red silk flag, and there he was marching ahead of it. But at the end of that day, we caught up with what was left of it, and there was very little left of it. They'd marched into an ambush of the Khmer Rouge, who were using up-to-date weapons, cordless rifles, mortars, machine guns a lot, and they'd simply blown this little column apart. And I remember a very tragic little scene. This little 12-year-old kid had been killed, and an American photographer, who I knew very well, was kneeling by him, weeping. It was that tragic. It was like, you know, virginity lost, innocence betrayed. You know, think of the cliches, and they all applied. And this photographer, this American, was weeping, and he found the flag. And you know how the Americans fold up the stars and stripes in a very well rehearsed way? They fold it into a small square, and they put it on the top of a coffin, a military coffin. And that's what he did. He folded up this very large silk flag, which was blooded, into this little square and placed it on the dead boy's chest. I should always remember that. And that was my first introduction to war in Cambodia.
Were you based in Phnom Penh at that time?
No. Excuse me. No. I wasn't based. If I was based anywhere, it was Saigon. But of course, you couldn't travel backwards and forwards to Phnom Penh. Phnom Penh was the capital. People say Phnom Penh. That's how it's spelled. But I think we used to call it Phnom Penh. It's named after a widow of a former Cambodian emperor. In the middle of Phnom Penh itself is a kind of hillock surrounded by trees, and on the top is a small, tiny little monument to the widow. I think that's why it gets its name. You have to. I was talking about the beauty of Cambodia, and Phnom Penh itself was a staggeringly beautiful place. Saigon must have been once, and Hanoi, as I discovered many years later, was still a very elegant city. And great, it was a city of stature, very French, of course. I mean, beautifully French, wide streets, boulevards, tall trees, avenues of trees, lovely French buildings. The Royal Palace itself, it must be one of the most exquisite palaces in all of Asia. Absolutely exquisite, and they would have dances there. You know, the typical traditional Cambodian dances. I remember on Sunday afternoons, you could go along close to, there's a big kind of boulevard, promenade really, along the river, the Mekong River, which flows through the city, this promenade faces the palace. And Sunday afternoons, there would be people out there, and the elephants would be out, and there'd be elephant rides, and there'd be people selling balloons, there'd be dancing troupes collecting, you know, a bit of money for themselves, jugglers. It was like a fair, and people would put on their best clothes, and they would just promenade, a bit like they do in some Italian cities still, promenade up and down, talking. Magic place to be. And just down, further down from Phnom Penh, only half an hour's drive, was a lovely little park, again typically French, nicely laid out, were quite formal. There was a bandstand there, and there would be a little orchestra, a small orchestra, playing Western music as well as the Cambodian traditional music, and people would sit out there drinking tea, and they'd have picnics. It was all terribly, terribly civilized. It was called Chong Ek. I remember, I said they played French music. I remember them playing Offenbach on one occasion. Chong Ek. And because of its obvious gentility, middle class gentility, it was the place where, at the end of the war, Pol Pot, who we'll talk about later, decided he would have his killing fields. He chose it deliberately to kill the middle class, because that, when he was a young man in Phnom Penh, an aspiring communist leader, must have envied the middle classes going there for their Sunday afternoon teas and their Offenbach. Chong Ek, the killing fields. Well, when the war began, after that tragic first day, the Americans kept very much back, of course. They weren't officially in Cambodia. In fact, Nixon says, you know, it wasn't necessary to go in, we would never go in, but we all knew they were there. But until they became very obvious, a year or so later, the Cambodians did their best to fight their own war. we had a Cambodian press information officer who we went to afternoon briefings with, and believe it or believe it not, his name was A.M., surname Rong, R-O-N-G. His name was Am Rong, and he was the Cambodian press information officer. So, you know, you can imagine the delight with which we received that. But I have to say, to be fair to us all, we were all, I don't know, overwhelmed by what was happening in Cambodia. The usual cynical press corps felt a great deal of sympathy for the Cambodians, because we could see where it was going to end, even if the Cambodians couldn't. We knew they were going to be dragged into a very bloody war, because that was the Americans' intention. So I think, you know, we probably laughed at Amrong only for a short time. There was another rather lovely story. They were very keen because they inherited the French system on censorship. And it was very necessary in order to get your copy to the telex, international telex. It was all telex in those days, of course. International telex operator, you had to have your copy, your stories, stamped, passed by the censor, a military censor. And the censor's office was opposite a rather beautiful cafe called Café de la, Restaurant de la Poste. Again, very French, which serves superb coffee and croissant, you know, all the delicacies you'd expect in a French cafe. And I'd sit there under the awning and watch this long line of journalists, international journalists, queuing up to go to the censor. And then I would go in because I was under no urgency. I think that we had to have our film on the afternoon flight, late afternoon flight, to either to Hong Kong or Bangkok. So once it was, I would go in, and the press were always complaining how particular, how meticulous this French-speaking Cambodian military officer was. Everything was blue-lined out. You can't do this, and you can't say that. No criticism here. So they, you know, they had a hell of a bad job. And yet, when I went in with my commentary, he would look at it and smile, and he would stamp passé on it. And I was delighted, because I was just as critical of what was happening as anybody else. I could never understand why, until I discovered, of course, that he couldn't speak a word of English. He could speak a little English, but he couldn't read English. But being the kind of nation they were, very, very, very dignified and very proud, of course, he didn't want to admit that he couldn't read English, so he simply passed it. It didn't matter, because, you know, I'd already recorded it, and he wouldn't have listened to the recording. But I never had any problems with the censor, and everybody else did. What else do we talk about? Right. People always... one of the questions people always ask you is you know, how do you cover a war? I remember when I first went to Cambodia, I was taken over from another reporter called Richard Lindy, who eventually joined the BBC. And I remember turning up, saying to him, you know, where do you go for the war? How do you know where to go? You know, how do you know what story to cover? And he said, well, you don't. You just look for it. And that, in fact, is what we did. We were so used to being cosseted in Vietnam by the American military. I've already told you how easy it was to cover that war. It was the communicator's dream. You remember I told you that all you had to do was to ring up the American press information and they would lay anything on that you wanted, and they would take you there by helicopter and bring you back. I mean, it was so easy peasy. In Cambodia, it was, you were on your own. There was nobody to tell you where to go or where not to go. So you simply got into your car or your taxi or whatever, and you drove up the road. Now, a lot of it's hearsay. You know, somebody's heard somebody say there's been a massacre or there's been an ambush, and you pick it up. That's why it's always essential to live in a hotel where there are lots of other journalists, because you get the buzz. I mean, if you see a television crew suddenly pick up the gear and rush out of the door, you know there's something on. If you see somebody rushing into the telex machine or getting rather excited over his notebook, you know, wow, there's something happening. It's always essential. It's very hard to tell the bosses this, because they want to put you into the cheapest little dunghole they can find, but it's essential that you stay in the hotel where all the other press are. That's how you pick up so much. It's a mutual exchange. Sometimes I pick up my gear and rush out the door and give the alert. You know, it's a shared thing. In Vietnam, in Cambodia, what we used to do, and we did this in towards the end of the Vietnamese War when the Americans had gone, you just go up a road where you've heard there might be activity, or you look in the sky and you see aircraft diving, you know, 20 or 30 miles away, or you see plumes of smoke, that gives you a clue as to where the war is.